Something peculiar happened in 1957 when Sputnik pierced the sky. Hannah Arendt noticed that people weren't just excited about space travel. They seemed relieved, as if humanity had finally found the exit door from a prison called Earth. This wasn't the usual grumbling about hard work or suffering. For the first time, people were complaining about being stuck on the planet itself. This moment crystallized a troubling question. What happens when we start treating our only home as something to escape rather than inhabit? The human condition emerged as Arendt's response. And 6 decades later, as we scroll through feeds curated by algorithms and contemplate Mars colonies, her warnings feel less like philosophy and more like prophecy. She asked us to think what we are doing. 3 simple words that contain our hardest challenge. Yesterday, you likely ate breakfast, answered emails, solved problems, and made decisions with others. Without realizing it, you moved through 3 fundamentally different modes of existence that Arendt called labor, work, and action. Labor is the biological treadmill we can't escape. Cooking dinner, knowing you'll be hungry tomorrow, doing laundry that piles up again, maintaining a body that constantly needs attention. The ancient Greeks saw this as slightly tragic, all that effort producing nothing lasting, just keeping the machine running. This is animal laborance, the laboring animal, forever bound to necessity's wheel. Work creates durability. The carpenter builds a table that outlasts them. The architect designs buildings that shelter generations. This is Homo Faber, the maker, who fabricates a stable world of objects. Unlike labor's endless cycle, work has beginnings and endings. Action is where we become most fully human, when you speak up in a meeting, start a difficult conversation, or join others to change something, that's action. It happens directly between people, revealing who you are beyond your job title. Action is unpredictable, irreversible, and powerful precisely because it's plural. Modern life constantly confuses these categories. We treat politics like household management, reducing action to labor. We approach relationships as problems to solve, reducing action to work. These category errors matter because misidentifying what we're doing means applying the wrong standards. Ancient Greeks sharply divided household from city. Households managed survival and inequality. Cities were where freedom began. Citizens met as equals to debate and act. Politics meant transcending necessity, standing among peers neither ruling nor ruled. Modernity erased this boundary, creating the social, neither public nor private. Household concerns like economics became collective administration, transforming society into one giant household. Citizens became consumers or producers. Politics became management. This explains contemporary life's peculiar quality. Social media creates spaces neither truly public nor genuinely private. We broadcast personal details while lacking real forums for collective action. Politics feels like glorified accounting because economic concerns dominate public discourse. The Greeks kept household matters private because necessity's demands, eating, reproducing, surviving, don't require the freedom and equality that politics demands. When we make everything public, we extend necessity's reach into what should be free spaces. When everything becomes collective management, nothing remains for genuine political action. Imagine telling an ancient Roman that future people would introduce themselves by their jobs and feel ashamed about unemployment. They'd think you're describing slavery. For the ancients, labor was what you minimized to pursue higher callings, politics, philosophy, art. The Greek word for labor shares its root with pain. Then everything shifted. Locke discovered that labor creates property. Smith found it produces wealth. Marx declared it defines human essence. By the 20th century, we'd built entire societies around labor centrality, defining worth by productivity and identity by employment. Here's the paradox. Just as we elevated labor to society's highest value, automation began making it unnecessary. Marx envisioned this contradiction, defining humans as laboring animals while dreaming of a world without labor. As robots and algorithms absorb more work, we face a crisis we're philosophically unprepared for. What gives life meaning when labor disappears? We've built a culture where labor provides income, structure, purpose, identity, and social connection. Strip it away, and we're left with a void. The ancient Greeks knew that freedom from necessity was just the beginning. You still needed to know what to do with that freedom. We've lost that knowledge. We spend leisure consuming things, scrolling feeds, filling emptiness with entertainment. We've become laborers without labor, and consumption has rushed in to fill the gap. While labor sustains life, work builds the durable world we inhabit. Buildings, bridges, books, and paintings create stability against nature's flux, an in-between that connects and separates us, providing the stable setting that makes meaning possible. Modern consumer society undermines this permanence. Smartphones last 2 years, clothes one season, furniture barely survives a move. We're drowning in disposable objects while losing worldliness, surrounded by stuff that provides no stability. Planned obsolescence isn't just economic strategy, it's an assault on our need for a durable world. Art represents worldliness at its peak. Objects created not for use or consumption, but for permanence itself. A painting endures because it's beautiful, establishing a kind of immortality. Totalitarian regimes understand this power. Burn the books, destroy the monuments, erase the past. Digital culture presents a curious paradox. We preserve digital objects perfectly, yet they lack material presence. Your grandmother's handwritten letters had worldliness, physical objects connecting past to present. Your text messages float in an immaterial cloud. What kind of world are we building when our most important communications exist only as data? Action embodies our freedom to begin something genuinely new. When you challenge injustice, organize neighbors, or start a conversation that changes minds, you're exercising action's power. Unlike labor cycles or work's predictability, action breaks established patterns to initiate the unexpected. This power carries profound risks. Action is irreversible. You can't unsay words or undo deeds. It's unpredictable. You never fully control how others respond. And it's revealing. Through action, you disclose who you are in ways you can't manage. Authoritarian regimes fear this unpredictability, attempting to replace action with predictable administration. The myth of the strong leader acting alone misses action's essence. Power emerges from the responses action generates. Rosa Parks initiated something by refusing to give up her seat, but the Montgomery bus boycott required thousands responding with their own actions. Arendt identifies two faculties that mitigate action's risks. Forgiveness releases us from past actions that might otherwise bind us forever, while promises establish islands of predictability in uncertain futures. Both require plurality. You can't meaningfully forgive yourself or make promises only to yourself. We treat every problem as technical rather than political. Climate change needs better technology. Inequality needs better policies. Democracy needs better systems. This technocratic mindset replaces political judgment with technical calculation, reducing citizens to clients of bureaucratic systems. Genuine politics emerges from human plurality, unique individuals inhabiting the world together. Through speech and action in public spaces, we reveal our distinct identities while addressing common concerns. This requires courage to speak without certainty and judgment to think from multiple perspectives. The dignity of politics lies in what technocracy eliminates, the freedom to begin something new, the plurality that makes persuasion necessary, the judgment that can't be replaced by calculation. When we treat political questions as technical problems, we lose the capacity for freedom itself. Yet genuine politics keeps breaking through. During crises, people spontaneously organize into assemblies where citizens deliberate as equals. These experiments demonstrate our persistent capacity for political renewal, even when bureaucracy eventually absorbs them. The challenge isn't rejecting expertise, but subjecting it to political judgment. Should we deploy this technology? How should we organize our economy? These are political questions requiring deliberation among citizens, not technical problems for experts to solve in isolation. Arendt's call to recover political dignity isn't nostalgia, it's a lifeline. Stop treating human questions as technical problems. Find spaces where you can speak and act with others as equals. Remember that you're not just a consumer, but a citizen capable of beginning something new.